He told Tessa to stay there in the hall and went down to the back door again, bent over Saxby's body, then reached down and pulled him inside. His bullets had caught the man in the right side, both within a few centimetres of each other. Ronnie thought they must have passed straight through the rib cage and possibly into the heart. Had to be something like that, as Saxby seemed to have died instantly. The eyes were open, glazed, and had no hint of fear in them. He literally couldn't have known what hit him. By now a plan was almost fully formed in Ronnie's mind, usable only if no backup appeared or the local law didn't show. If they had tracked him, knew who he was, Ronnie wouldn't be a fool, wouldn't try to shoot it out with them. What could he expect? Maybe 10 years? 15? Or would they try to take him out? Make it look like a battle to the death? Well, at least it would be quick. Ronnie was not afraid of dying. As with anybody, there were occasional moments of fragmentary fear. But death was some kind of new beginning, he thought. "The last enemy," he said aloud. Tess called to him from the stairs, asking what he'd said.
"Couldn't hear you, love."
"I may be blown," he said, going back into the hall, looking up and giving her what passed for a sheepish grin. Then he told her of his fears about Saxby, then the various options as he saw them. He went through the possibilities to test the water, using the body, bringing the girl up from the hotel, making their escape. As he spoke, he knew that his mind was in confusion.
"You're absolutely certain the girl is a cop?"
Tess asked. "I don't know. I'd swear she moved like a cop. They all have that way of walking, sort of flat-footed. I'd have put money on it." As they talked, he moved from room to room, watching both back and front, expecting a motor launch to come roaring across the lake, floodlights shattering the darkness, or a fleet of police cars screaming up from the direction of the town. He wondered if any of the neighbours had heard the small explosion. Doubted it. The nearest was too far away.
"And you're certain about this fellow? What'd you call him?"
"Saxby."
"Saxby?"
"Lenny Saxby. What about him?"
"You're certain he's working for MI5, or whatever they're calling it these days?"
For the first time, Ronnie seriously started to question it.
"No old scores to settle?"
Tessa had come up close to him. For a second he thought of that Shakespeare play, the one about the Scottish king. He'd seen a production in modern dress, and Macbeth and his lady had moved around just as Tessa and he were doing now. "With me? Lenny and me? Old scores?"
"No, Lenny and the Pope. What do you think, Ron?"
He thought about Edwards's death on that cold, damp morning. Saxby standing over him with the pistol. Richardson's refusal to tone down the evidence. Saxby's face as they left the inquiry. Stone-faced. The face of a man who could kill. No. Ronnie rejected it, then brought it into the open. "He might harbour the odd grudge."
"Enough to want you in a grave?"
He thought about it again. "Maybe. I don't know." If you wanted to be optimistic about the situation, it was a great theory. Not Lenny, no. I mean, he did a stupid thing, but... After a while...
"So you want me to go down and bring the girl back here?"
Tess sounded cool and in control. "If you think you can act as though it's me lying here with my face blown off, if you've enough bottle to force the bitch back here..."
"I'll frighten the bejesus out of her."
Tess sounded hard, psyched up. "I've taught her well," he thought. Aloud, he said there was nobody out there. Nobody on the lake, and only normal traffic moving along the road to Italy.
Could Saxby have... "You won't do anything to his face until I've gone down to the hotel. I'll try and get her in her room."
"No." Ronnie was adamant. "No. Meet her in public. Best not to face her until there are people around. Reason with her. Frighten her to death."
"Give me a gun, Ron."
Tess grinned, anticipating the danger and the buzz it would bring. He looked startled, for she seldom called him Ron. "If it's dodgy, I'll finish her off here. Put her lights out, and then we'll go and see to the Bortunians in London. Make some money, eh? For the pension fund, what?" Tess gave him a tiny shake of the head, as though she knew it was no good trying to argue. She made coffee, and he brought her an automatic pistol. "Cattle prodder for that cow," he said, laughing. They drank the coffee and waited. Then at last she left, and he got to work getting an old blazer onto the body, wrestling with the stiffening muscles. then dragging it into the room at the front of the house, and firing two silent shots at close range straight into the side of the face. He thought of other men he had seen dead, and others he imagined. His head buzzed with the symbols of death. As things turned out, Tessa put on a convincing act, but they were both shaken by the sudden arrival of the backup. Ronnie was upstairs, cheering Tessa on when the little car screamed to a stop across the street, and Patsy's gangly figure came through the open door. It had surprised Ronnie because he was still thinking of Lenny as the shadow. The whole thing left them jumpy, twitchy, so that they hardly spoke to one another during the ride up the lake in the motor launch. Tessa had a stinking headache, and her left ear was numb and deafened from the cupped-handed blow from Bex. Ronnie brooded, remaining silent until they were in a hired car, tooting toward Malpensa, the nearest of Milan's two airports. "You were bloody good," he told Tess. "You got more bottle than a liquor store."
"I've been well trained, so."
That girl had been terrified of the two IRA hoods in Dublin seemed to have come from a different planet in another time. In Paris that night, entering with new untraceable passports, they searched the news web pages and surfed the TV channels without seeing anything that could be linked with a death by shooting on Lake Maggiore. "We might have muddied the waters for just long enough." Richardson looked tired. "I really should have killed that girl when we had her." Tess inwardly shuddered. He sounded as cold-blooded as an alligator.
"I thought you were being a bit too clever for your own good," she said,
not expecting a response. Ronnie was not used to criticism from Tessa. Bloody political correctness and the empowerment of women, he thought, dismissing it as it crossed his mind. "Don't get yourself out of date, Ronnie," he told himself. Maybe it was really time to stop, for he hadn't seen the cavalry coming in its little scarlet and silver Tirano due. Hadn't spotted its existence. Hadn't detected Lenny Saxby either, come to that. Couldn't really put it all together yet. Found it difficult to believe Saxby had the balls to try to take him out. Mistook Saxby for some secret heavy. God, the guy must have been on the property more than once, and he didn't even know, hadn't detected him. Ronnie had meant to install CCTV at the back, but never got around to it. Bad. Very bad. Over the hill, he wondered. On the Sky News from London, they were talking about the forthcoming visit of President Madame Bortunin. Already some of the Yank contingent had arrived. Smooth suits alighted from Black Rovers in front of Downing Street, and the PM came down to greet the newly appointed US Secretary of State with a kiss. She was fair, glowing with health and good grooming, slender and winsome, the new secretary, which made a change. "Best figure ever to come out of Washington," said one of the presenters, and his female colleague gave him a filthy look on camera.
"Have you got to do this one?"
Tessa asked yet again, her voice scratchy with concern. "We've taken the money."
"You can give it back, Ronnie, please."
"No, it's what I do well." A grin, looking away, for he really wondered if he did do it well any more. He supposed that, for him, this was the ultimate test.
"Make it the last one, then?"
"Probably, yes. Possibly." Maybe she was right. It wasn't the money. Ronnie Richardson had lately, within the last few hours, become conscious of age. Time's winged chariot. He tried the schoolboy grin again, knowing it wasn't boyish any more. He called a police contact in Geneva, who knew him only as the man who paid him a large sum of money, in cash, each month, using the name Paramore. The contact said he'd check it out.
"The Locarno area?"
he queried. "Maggiore. No, make it all of Ticino. I'll call you back." Which he did an hour later. "Only odd thing, there's a reported sighting of a known British security hack crossing the border at Brissago last night. Back again this morning and out with an unidentified British female." "Known? How known?" "He's not exactly welcome in Switzerland. Got caught with his hand in an illegal wiretap in 89. We don't stop him, but it's always noted." "Where was the wiretap?" "Old history, Basel. Don't know if he still works for the Brits." "Description?" The police contact rattled off an immediately recognizable description. "Patrick Wright, known generally as Patsy. Don't know the bugger. Can you get me an update on him? I'll call you tomorrow. Ronnie scowled again as he put down the telephone. We'll take a look-see in London, see how it lies, see what's going on, who's watching what, hearing what, and all that. So that's how things stood. Ronnie and Tessa heading quietly into London with the killing of President and Madame Bortunin much on their minds. Bex Olesker and Patsy Wright coming in from Switzerland, via Italy, Milan, picking up instructions to go pull Charlie Gauntlet out from among the monks. These monks kosher, sir? Bex asked Commander Joe Bain. Kosher as spoiled gefilte fish, Bain said with an odd look. But what did he know? He'd just spoken at length to his opposite number in Zurich, alerting him to a body in Brissago. That had been more than a shade embarrassing. Now he carefully briefed Bex, and a couple of hours later summed up. I'm sure it's a coincidence, Charlie being there with the dread Kit Kat. But you can see it poses a problem to our security brethren.
And some, Bex nodded.
We thought it best for you to go and pull him out personally. I mean, it's as good an excuse as any. Gives you the right kind of cover. There's some confusion.
As well there might be.
Indeed, what with all that money coming and going. Maybe the revenue should have a team there.
You really just want me to lift Charlie out? Really? That's all?
Well, no. I want you to hang on in London for a day or two. You see, Bex, our friends made the man who picked up the Murray woman when you lost her in Dublin. They know who he is, and they want to pump him dry.
They posed a problem, Joe said. The friends needed to give him a heavy interrogation, flush him out, drain him, and that would mean sidestepping the law slightly.
Just hang about, would you?
Yes, sir. Okay.
As Bex understood it, funnies were going to lift the man who had driven the battered rover in Dublin. Lift him, she thought, then give him a drug-assisted interrogation. In the early years of the 21st century, the techniques of chemically assisted interrogation had advanced incredibly. In the bad old days of the Cold War, people spoke loosely of sodium pentothal as the truth drug, giving the impression that all you had to do was shove a hypo in the subject's arm and ask the questions. It was more involved than that, and a good deal more hit and miss. But nowadays, like everything else, new drugs were on the market, and even newer, sophisticated techniques. You could not expect anyone to stand up to interrogations nowadays. There were many ways of prizing the truth from people without resorting to violence. With the new methods had come a backlash. Political correctness had reached an idiotic high, and human rights activists caused endless problems to law enforcement agencies.
You'll have that fellow Wright with you, Joe Bain told her. He's a handy man to have around. A very present help in trouble, they say.
I'll bear that in mind, sir.
And she did.
And Charlie? Charlie sat quietly under the huge, vaulted roof of Ringmarocki's monastery chapel, his mind whirling with possibilities and wedges of worry. But mainly Charlie was angry. In truth, Charlie was furious, because the monks had kept him locked up for over 24 hours.